We are not heroes, nor are we villains, neither kings nor magicians, but we can tell you their stories. We are the Lore Keepers, and we welcome you to Halloween.
Welcome to Halume. You've tuned into Lore Keepers, a podcast for your bod. Nice bod. It's a podcast devoted to chronicling the serialized world building of a sprawling tapestry of interwoven lore. Oh, right. Sorry, I'm Frank.
And I'm Carter.
Carter's like, and I'm unsure of whether I should just dip out now. This season, our focus is on gods, faith, and the relationship between mortals and immortals. So sit back, close your eyes, and let our tingling audio gateway sweep you into the realms of Halume.
This week, we are talking about demigods, specifically demigodhood as a amuse-bouche for the kind of prospective gods in kind of Avum Tertius, who the pantheons don't want to just, like, let everyone ascend. They want to have, like, you know, they want to gatekeep godhood. And so they're like, why don't you just take, we'll give you this demigodhood, but you're not going to be like us.
So girl boss, gaslight, gatekeep, demigod.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so this kind of was, oh, go ahead.
I want to begin with an example from antiquity, Frank. You know I like to do this.
Sure.
Heracles.
Of course. My boy. Of course, it's got to be Heracles. Boy Heracles.
Famously, son of Zeus, is a demigod. In part, I think, mostly, maybe, because of his heritage, right? He is the son of the big boy god and immortal. So, which we would call... Frankie, you all right there?
Frankie, sorry, I don't know why, but I was like... But his name was Heracles Zebediah Zeusen.
So, Heracles...
Or Zeb to his friends.
Hey, I don't know, would you describe someone who was born of a god in, like, D&D, for instance? Would you describe them as, like, an Osimar, or are they... Or is that just angel-born?
I mean, I think it depends on how we handle Osimar.
Yeah.
Which also, before we get too deep into this, really quick, I did want to just throw out there, if you are curious for follow-up on our conversation about gods and whether they can read, you might actually be interested in checking out the end of the episode, the amble, because we may have come to some kind of an agreement, or at least like a ceasefire, which is not usual. I did not think that would just come out of nowhere, but I don't know. It seems like it works.
Frank, when you become reasonable, we can come to a ceasefire, and that's what happens.
Yeah. Anyways, yes, I think it depends on how you define, what an Asimar is in Halume. I mean, we know that it can be through sort of like divine, not divine, sort of a blessed favor over your family, like maybe there's an association with a god and a devotion to that god, and so one of the houses associated with that god, maybe something comes through there. So I mean, I guess what I would say is if a no, I think that something that is born of literally like the scion of a god is not an Asimar.
It's something greater.
And I don't think it's an angel either, because angels are formed by the animus, right?
Yes. Like angels, the houses are not embodied necessarily. They're spiritual beings that can be, but I think that
right, the scion they of a put god, on a body is I think the way that you've talked about it. Yeah, like literally you have like fashioners
with, the scion of a god with a human or a knowing creature with a mortal would have to be necessarily embodied.
Yes.
I think.
Yeah. And it's possible that they could be imparting their spirit on them. Yeah.
When their spirit ascends to the Ethereum when they die or what have you, that might, they might get some special perks there. But for their time on the Materium, they are embodied and they can't just shed their body like an angel could.
Yeah. I think that they probably have some sort of divine favor, blessings, magical, you know, whole, like divine magics of some kind. But I think in general, they still are bound to a mortal body. Maybe that mortal body is like Heracles, you know, and like can't be wounded or like is tremendously strong Heracles or whatever. Can be wounded. He can, but it's hard, right?
I don't think
like, stabbing with a spear, he's still probably fine.
Well, no, he's not like Luke Cage.
What about Thanos? Who would win in a fight, Thanos or Heracles?
Heracles.
You think Heracles would win a fight? Because yeah. Thanos' skin can't be pierced.
Is this Thanos? Well, I mean, Heracles famously killed something whose skin can't be pierced.
Oh, well, I don't know, man.
So the Nemean lion, Frank, could not, its hide couldn't be pierced by any weapon. So he snapped its neck. And then from its mouth, stripped off its hide, because you could get in from the mouth. And then wore its hide as a cloak, so he had basically invulnerable armor.
That's pretty funny, actually. He's walking around in a fursuit, literally? Like he's sticking his arms through the paws and stuff? Okay. You're saying he like tore the innards out of the lion and then climbed into them? And just like popped his arms and like he's in a bedtime onesie.
No, basically you can't pierce it, but I think like he managed to cut it from cutting in the mouth.
Oh Jesus. Oh my god. So he managed to fashion
a cloak out of it.
Gotcha. Anyways, yes, you're talking about Heracles. What was the point of bringing him up?
Because this is like the demigod of antiquity. And so like how will our demigod look like Heracles? In what ways will it be different? In what ways will it be the same? So I want to say, like, Heracles has certain divine gifts. He's incredibly strong. He's huge. He's, like, a huge guy. He's also, like, he gets rewarded in the afterlife, or, like, when he's completed his labors, what have you, with, like, becoming a god, basically. So that's going to be different, obviously. But otherwise, he's, like, immortal. He dies. Just like any other
one. So part of the question that comes into play then is, when would a mortal acquire demigodhood? Like, is it sometime during their life or death or birth, by birth? Is it something where like they were a demigod before they were born? You know, sort of maybe there's some kind of Jesus analog, right? And, you know, like Jesus, the most common read in Christianity, existed for since, you know, time began, and Jesus isn't technically, according to that story, doctrine at least, you know, isn't really a demigod. He's fully God, but
God,
you understand what I mean. You know, he occupied, became flesh, that whole thing.
I have some ideas, by the way, about what we want.
Okay. Yeah, let me just, I'm just going to connect this one to the last episode, and then we'll go from there. Okay. Does that sound good?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. It's not going to take long. It's just basically like we kind of mentioned this last episode. And while I was editing the one on like crusades and stuff like that, the idea of, you know, we were kind of getting inspired by this idea of, you know, early Avum Tertius, the gods come back. They see things, you know, first they come back sort of almost as like a blessing. You know, the saviors of the people or whatever, like, oh, fine, you know, this echo from ages past. And then rapidly it becomes something far more violent and dangerous because they're reacting to all these people who are using the combination of the whelming and the fact that the gods are not as present to respond to, like, consensus reality being changed. So that they're like literally using magic in ways that basically allows them to have ascendancy, like the number of gods that ascend goes from like maybe one, which is like the blood empress or whatever. And I think that maybe she had a kind of at least immortality. I don't know if she was actually full on god, but I think that if you are the empress or queen, or I don't remember what she was, but of like the, you know, the blood elves for,
I think Empress is the correct term.
Yeah, I think it was Empress. Of the sanguine elves, I mean, they'd have to have an empress, you know, that's how they are. They need to have their kings and queens and stuff. But for as long as she was, like, you necessarily are warping consensus reality, you know, like to the point where people, your name is almost like an omen. But yeah, anyway, so like early on, there's this like, you know, these first ascendancies, people are suddenly like one person discovers it. And then all of a sudden, you know, whole swaths of continents are being like splintered into the almost like tribal zealous groups that are following their own personal Heracles type champion that is just, you know, doing hyper powerful shit, you know, especially because people are looking to leaders during the whelming.
Killing hydras.
There's so much conflict going on. And then the gods bring the banhammer down. They just start like axing people left and right. They're like saying, oh, you know, like this is, you know, these people, we deem them unworthy of godhood or whatever. And it's like, you know, the people are like, some of them are terrified of the god. Well, these are the real gods, right? We've actually seen the real gods. And so then they begin to worship them. And then there's the curse of worship. It's a total mess.
Yeah. Miley Cyrus comes in like a wrecking ball.
Like a wrecking ball. Oh my God. So anyways, this stuff all happens. And then what, one of the things we talked about was like the gods sort of coming to some kind of compromise with mortals and saying like, okay, well, we let one in. And maybe that one like killed somebody else, maybe not their patron, but killed some other god or destroyed them, because I guess you can't really kill them, right? But like they destroyed them and then took their place or something, because they're like, oh, only I'm worthy. You know, like this person was doing a bad job. This god was doing a bad job. I need to take their throne or something. And all the gods are like, you can't fucking do that. They freak out. Yeah. And, you know, get upset at all the mortals. And eventually something changes. They do something to reality that fundamentally changes the process of achieving godhood. And I don't think it's impossible. Like, I definitely think that there's like necromancers or liches or whatever who are doing a kind of god, like, you know, the Vecna type shit of campaign one. I think that that's possible on some level, but it's like some really dark artsy shit that you have to like make some pretty big significant sacrifices. There's no way of getting out of that without like searing your soul in some way. But part of the reason why they are able to kind of make this work somehow is by limiting people's access to godhood to demigodhood. And I think maybe before this time, maybe demigods didn't exist. You know, I mean, on some level, like Aven Prima, kind of everybody was a demigod. You know, you think about what the aspects are and what they're made out of. So with that as being almost like this solution, this compromise between mortals and immortals, I mean, it kind of makes sense too, right? It's kind of the half step between the divine and the mortal. So that does question, you know, it is a question though of like, yeah, do they reside in the Materium? Do they sort of just pass on to the Ethereum when they die? Do they go to the Ethereum early? Maybe it's not that strict, you know?
Answers for you.
Yeah, go for it, man.
So they said two things. The gods basically said like, look, we're enshrining it in the aspects that demigodhood is a thing, and this is what happens when you are awarded with or achieve demigodhood. You are immortal, such that you cannot age, or, you know, you cannot age past your prime, whatever it is, you're always in the physical prime, and you cannot become ill. However, without, like, magical poison or something like that. However, you can be killed. It's possible.
Okay.
And
I mean, I assume there's also some power that you get with a domain.
Yeah, you may get some, depending
on...
Is
it like contracted out from an existing domain, or are they creating new domains?
I think that it might be run... Demigodhood might come in two tracks. One is an award given by a god who has the power to do this. Okay. So that would be under their domain. And you'd be like a demigod under their purview. They would be responsible for you. And then the other track is awarded by the Animus.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
But I didn't get
I like that. Thing. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, yeah. Keep going.
So in this way, I'm saying like they're like the elves in a way from Tolkien, where like they are immune to disease and they are immune to like age. However, they can still be killed. And they may even be like, you know, immune to like non-magical weapons or stuff like this, but you know, we can hash that stuff out. But the second thing is that when they die, they go to a special place in the Ethereum, like the Elysium Fields or something like this. That is reserved for demigods.
Okay, yeah, almost kind of a Valhalla sort of situation.
Yeah, just you know,
like
maybe
a unique
less
place where all of the mightiest people go.
Yeah,
sure. A special heaven for the one percenters.
Exactly.
I mean, I kind of like that. Like the gods are not managing this very well. is I think if anything that the season has taught me is that the gods are not like
they're doing
the
best.
Greatest of. They're doing as good as they can, but also are they?
It reminds me of. Like, have you ever read the book The City of Ember?
Oh my god, what an incredible book! Hey, no spoilers.
Yep.
Don't give any spoilers away.
Yep.
What a great book! I love that book.
Yeah, it reminds me of that. Where like they don't really know how to fix all the things that are broken, so they're like, let's just do our best to keep everything going.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good description. Carter, if you aren't familiar with the book, what Carter's talking about is so the City of Ember takes place in like a land where there's like no day, and so as a result. The city's literally called Ember because it's kind of like the last sort of dying ember in this, you know, dark land. The entire city is kept lit, you know, with these electrical lights by some kind of huge machine. You know, it's a power plant of some kind that's in the city and was meant to sort of, you know, keep on going and has just slowly broken down more and more over time. And people don't actually know how it got put together in the first place. And so they're just doing their best to keep it running for as long as they can, which is like such an evocative image of just like being on the edge of like survival, you know, like the city just, there's like these rolling blackouts that get worse and worse over the book. And like, ah, oh, it's what a good book, man. That was one of my biggest holy fuck moments as a kid, like reading that and then like realizing sort of everything that was going on. It's a good book. Good book. But yeah, I think that that's a good comparison. I will say though, I think that they have to have something that differentiates them from Tolkien's elves, because I don't necessarily think of Tolkien's elves as like demigods. You know, they're very much like beyond your typical mortal, but like I don't know, I guess I think of demigods
right.
More as like you were saying with Heracles, you know.
Yeah, I think they need to get some extra power, but what that is I think depends on who's granting you the ability or like why, how you achieved mm-hmm. godhood or demigod.
Yeah, I think that maybe so there what part of what it might be is that there's almost like these papal-esque roles that a god might have as a sort of mantle, that they pick a person for a specific era and almost like let their presence rest on that individual, almost saying like, you are my, you know, it might be a cheaper alternative to having an avatar, right? You imbue a person you like emphatically trust with your being, your presence in the materium. And then you don't necessarily need to walk around and endanger maybe yourself or at least expend your power to be an aspect, especially if we do something like what we were kind of talking about, the Pax Demiurge, which, by the way, that's a reference to the architect. We'll have to revisit. Frank, write this down. We'll have to revisit at some point when we talk about the architect, the person who created the materium, for the listener who needs a refresher. Everything I've been learning about the like Gnosticism and the Demiurge, very fun comparator, because the whole thing was like they created the world and like now they're just kind of hands off.
Frank,
right?
Frank, write this
slumbers.
Down. Future Frank, write this down. The architect was enthroned.
I was thinking about that. I agree. I think the architect was enthroned. But anyway, so yeah, so maybe it's like that there's this kind of this mantle, especially if, you know, when we eventually do an episode on this, like sort of this pact or compact that, you know, the mortals go to the concert with and however they choose to respond with it, if there are some gods that go down with it, then by necessity of sort of like taking an oath to all of the materium or mortality and say, like, we will not sort of overextend ourselves or something. Maybe that's a solution for them, is like allowing for this mantle where it's a little foggier and there's more interpretation from the mortal side of being like, I think this is what this god stands for. And every generation that maybe changes, it's less of a direct thing. But in earlier stages, I think, like, especially, like, there, Avum Tertius is a long time, right? We talk about the whelming, and I think that we've kind of said the whelming is maybe around 300 to 500 years, somewhere around there. And even in the time after that, you know, we still have this, I think, kind of, like, this war, and the, like, the relationship between gods and mortals is really fraught and different, wildly different, depending on the god and the mortal that you're talking about. So I think that sometime in late Avum Tertius, once things get a little bit more ironed out, this is when kind of the demigod sort of system gets introduced. Not to say that they can't be before, but it just maybe looks different. But yeah, anyways, just what you're saying, I think that, like, the animus thing makes sense to me. And I think that this sort of a mantle being passed on to people also makes sense to me. And it doesn't have to be a mantle, but that's, like, maybe a way of looking at it.
When are the seven around, or the nine, the champions of the gods? Of the regions.
Well, they're definitely around during Avum Tertius, because at the end of Avum Tertius is when they're all in the Spire of Peace.
Yeah.
And there's, like, the one being...
When the nine become the seven, yeah.
Yeah, when the nine become the seven. So the seven is Avum Quartus. In Avum Tertius, it's the nine.
So I think they are the first...
And I think it's actually, like, a pretty clean split.
I think they're the first demigods. And they're a special case. Because they're a fusion of, like, angel and mortal souls.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if I agreed with you as much back when we first talked about it, but I'm starting to come around to the idea that the stuff that gods are made out of, like the divine material that makes up their spirit, is different than the stuff that makes up a mortal spirit. Not that one is lesser or greater than the other, necessarily, just... coming from a different source, or just, like, has a different effect. And I kind of like the idea that the nine have been imbued with, and I think this is maybe a part of demigodhood, in some way there's sort of a swapping out, or sort of an altering, a transforming, something changes about them, where they have access to this divine spirit that is different. And maybe that's what that lets them interface more readily with a domain. Like, maybe that's where some of that consensus reality power of the gods comes from. Because of their spirit, they have more direct access to Waylas or something like that than what a mortal has. And so, like, the demigods kind of have some access to it within, like, whatever their very specific domain is.
I'm just imagining, like, if you have true sight and you looked at one of the nine, you would, like, as they moved, you would see, like, a double of them move, like a tenth of a second behind them, like, because it's their other soul, like, over the other.
What's that metal that they burn in, the metal they burn in,
to see the future, or to, like, in, to predict?
Yes, in, you know what I'm talking about, in Mistborn.
Yes, let's see.
To see the future. Al something? It's like gold and aurum? No.
God metals. Gold, aurum. Atium. It's atium.
ATM, yeah. It's kind of like ATM, where sort of there's sort of almost a ghost image of their true nature, sort of sits over them or resides on them. And yes, and what you're saying, I think that the nine would probably be classified as a demigod in the same way that, like, octopuses are classified as fish, despite the fact that they share very little relationship with, like, just because they live in the water, they're a fish. You know, it'd be like looking at things that live on a mountain and just saying, oh, well, these are all goats.
Yeah.
Because they all live on mountains. But I think it's kind of something like that, where it's like there is something fundamentally different about them, because I think it's that they're fused to an archangel.
Yeah.
A solar. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Whereas I don't think that that's what's going on with most demigods.
Yeah, I think most demigods are just, like, elevated in some strange way by other gods or by the animus.
The animus.
And it's not a fusion of souls.
Okay, so to follow up with this, I had a kind of, I had a question I was wondering if you wouldn't mind discussing. How do you think that this relates to the aspects? Because we've talked about the aspects before as sort of, like, a reinterpretation of what we had looked at previously. Is it's, you aren't necessarily born an aspect or not. It can sometimes be, like, through life you sort of come to reflect that aspect's true nature, and if you really, like, connect with it, and like hit something real, it can sort of come on you almost like a muse, and you could almost be drawn to each other like magnets. I don't know if the animus is involved in that. I actually don't think that it is. They are, but that there is some sort of way where almost like if you live a life that is almost like the equivalent of sainthood, but for an aspect, you can almost be drawn up and into it and become sort of one with the rest of that nature of that aspect because you so accurately represent it. And there, it feels like something's happening here with the demigods, but I get the feeling that if the gods... like, I get the feeling that the demigods are almost like sort of the gods' solution to the aspects and almost like a replacement for them. Don't do that. That's sort of this weird, arcane heresy of some kind.
I don't think the gods understand the aspects.
Well, and that's the thing. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily that the gods think they're evil, but more that they're dangerous because they don't understand them, because they were never really meant to, because it was part of Own's plan, not theirs. And so they're left with half of the information, or less than half, right? Like the machinists of Ember. And they're just like, whatever this is clearly an endangerment to the machine. And it's going to harm the machine. We don't know what it's for. Did it have an original purpose? Maybe. Maybe the original city planners had a reason for this to exist. But whatever it is, it does not fit in this picture. And because of their nature, they are just limited to understand it. And so maybe they almost even see the aspects in reacting to it come up with some demigodhood. Like, there could have even been some kind of interplay like that.
Yeah. So yeah, I think they're definitely, it's very different. I think if you're a demigod, you're on an aspect. I think it might be possible you'd be both, but that's like super rare and weird.
That would be a fun thing to do, though.
Maybe
at some point we'll have to do that.
You know, he's everything.
Sure, why not? I think I still want Rakvar to just be so outside the box. He's not part of the aspects, he's not part of the demigods. He's just a dude who's like whose report card to death is just behind a filing cabinet, like just hasn't been found. Which is just, I don't know, so good. But yeah, no, I mean I think that there's something about I totally can picture demigods like kind of making war with aspects. And I also feel like or maybe war is a strong word, but like definitely conflict, right? I also feel like there is a difference in the kind of power that they carry. Like, I feel like demigods maybe have a more overt sort of control, and what the aspects have is less so. I don't know what that would be, but maybe like sort of difference between depth and width or breadth.
Maybe.
Kind of thing.
But I think the demigods are closely, more closely related to the gods than they are to like fundamental aspects of reality.
Yeah, aspects are wholly different because they're more associated with Waylas than gods.
Yeah.
And Waylas are like just sort of the body of Halume itself. And although the fact that gods, like, yes, they do arise out of the body of Halume, they contribute to its presence in a more passive sort of, the exhalations of the god become a part of the breath of Halume versus almost like active living cells of Halume itself, which I would kind of more see the aspects of, is almost like embodiments of the sort of the extension of the you know, Halume in a more direct way.
Yeah, and I think, for instance, like thinking of an aspect is someone who's like, as you're saying, this like embodies a part of Halume's very essence, whereas thinking of a demigod, you know, Heracles or maybe like even Achilles is a mortal who is immortal such that they don't age, is invulnerable in some respects to like all this normal things that would kill a mortal, and is incredibly powerful but can still die.
Okay. Without putting too much of a spin on it, well, okay, we'll have to just extract the spin from it. I think, how familiar are you with Narnia and, like, the stories of Narnia? Do you ever read them?
I think I read a few of them. Like, I'm not super familiar. It's been a decade.
Do you know the general tale of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Kids from Britain enter a wardrobe. There's, like, an evil witch, and then they work with the lion and the
Aslan,
weird satyr, to defeat the witch.
I think I've told you before, by the way, that they've just picked Tolkien and C.S. Lewis picked their worlds out of a hat. And that they, like, literally, we could have had a world where Tolkien wrote Narnia and C.S. Lewis wrote Lord of the Rings, which is, I'm like, ah, I want to read those books so bad. Yeah.
You need to go to the world where Reagan is getting, you know, a blowjob by that.
Oh my God.
By whoever. Whatever we were talking
just
about.
Just by the show for all mankind. Yeah, for just all the mankind. Show itself just constantly just wants to, like, what a noble last cowboy. Fuck. Okay, but no, so the reason why I bring that up is because...
Yeah, for me, Reagan.
Oh my God. I think that the relationship between, or the way that the White Witch displays power versus the way that Aslan displays power, it makes me, it's a association I'm making for demigods versus aspects, where like Aslan, I guess, spoilers for White Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe, which I feel like is like,
he's a talking lion. Know.
Yeah. The White Witch like does spells.
Yeah, quote the old magic to me, bitch.
I was there when it was written. Exactly. So like, well, the White Witch casts spells and is like very actively interfacing with the magic she understands. Whereas like Aslan, like, is the magic. Like, he is like the embodiment of sort of the stuff that the world that made the world. And so I think that for all the gods want to rule reality, aspects are reality, if that makes sense. And again, not to make a strong connotation, positive or negative, because there's definitely been very maligned aspects who have done horrible things. Yeah. Not just well-intentioned ones, like the ones who caused fucking 4,000 years of war. But like the demigods, the way that their power is definitely like, we are going to take what is there and modify or work with it. Whereas the aspects just simply are the thing. And so like Aslan, spoiler for real, I guess, comes back to life. Like, he, you know, does? The whole, it's sort of, it's the whole Jesus sacrifice on the cross thing. Like, he literally like gives himself up so that Edmund can be free. And he is like put on the stone table and the White Witch slams a dagger into his chest and kills him. And then in the morning, he literally just like comes back alive. He like comes free of the ropes that are binding him and stuff. It's very like overt Jesus imagery. But like the thing that he says when he comes back is he's like she was, you know, if she had known the true magics or was there, you know, kind of, well, it was written. Right. She would know that there's an even greater magic deeper than the one that she was using. And I think that there's a relationship like that with the gods. They know a lot. They know a tremendous amount, but they don't know everything.
And the aspects don't even know everything. They just are so intimately connected to the fabric of reality that they just do.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is I don't think that an aspect is casting spells, and I don't know if they have as conscious of an influence over reality. Like, I don't know if they're able to just sort of manipulate it at will. It's more sort of this unconscious extension
and a sorcerer,
of yeah I think, oh dude, that would actually be kind of cool to like, I bet that there are stories of sorcerers and wizards drawing their origins to these kinds of stories. You know, these myths and lore of like wizards are like the demigods and the sorcerers are like the aspects as the origins of these fields of magic. Although the aspects aren't really known like that. They're not really known as a thing, but there could be like stories, especially because I imagine sorcerer groups are pretty like, you know, cabal-esque and they're like, you know, close knit and stuff. Okay, so we have demigods. What do we do with them?
What do you mean, what do we do?
Well, so, okay, first of all, are all demigods, these, like, mighty men and women and, you know, and other who are, you know, just powerful like Heracles, or do they have other facets or natures of their power? You know, are they all able to lift a tree trunk, or are some just, like, really fast? Are they kind of, like, got superhero, like, power suite type things?
I'm thinking... we get a, like, maybe not as broad as superheroes, but certainly broader than just like me strong that Heracles has.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like Achilles, one of his famous things isn't that he's like super fucking strong. Achilles is incredibly fast. He can outrun anyone. Like, he's really good at racing. Like, what's foot racing Achilles? That's the thing. he always wins.
Is he fast, like, in the same way that Captain America is? Okay, that's actually a great describer. Is he the apex of human physique, which is often how, you know, Captain America is described, is, like, whatever the maximum human ability that a thing could ever be for something, he is all of them, versus, you know, like, the greatest Olympian who would win at every Olympics, versus somebody who's literally getting assistance from on high in a way that's, like, beyond what a mortal could ever do.
I think Achilles is probably closer to Captain America, whereas Heracles seems closer to the divine strength.
Okay, so there's kind of a spectrum. Well, and also I assume that not everything is about these, you know, divine feats that are... Sorry, go ahead.
I do think that there is, like, demigods that are known for their wisdom and knowledge.
That's where I was going to go with that, is not all of them are warriors or fighters. Absolutely. I mean, obviously, a lot of the Greco-Roman stuff, you know, is very much revolves around that because, you know, you have city-states that are constantly at war with each other. But also, like, yeah, I would imagine that there is demigodhood that comes from deep wisdom or, you know, the, you know, we give, who is it? It's, I can't remember who, but let me look it up. I think it's Prognan.
But, like, you know,
Prognan, who is the god of, like, faith. Uh-huh. We give that short shrift sometimes, but, like, faith is literally the foundation of reality, right? If they have, you know, they could be a god who sort of can change their reality at will in a more overt way than even others. You know, that might even literally be their domain, is like, you know, sort of believing in things and reasserting their existence.
Yeah, but, like, to use more ancient Greek examples that aren't just fighting, because I don't know, like, when I think demigods, I think the ancient Greeks. Like oracular powers, being able to see the future might be something a demigod has. And then that they use that to kind of gain understanding and wisdom, and then are, like, consulted to help solve problems. I think also, like, Chiron, the, like, great teacher who taught Achilles and Heracles and all this stuff, like, there might be a demigod of teaching who just, like, is able to educate well and to, like, rear up good people. And so he, like, tours around and gives lectures and stuff like this. And this is considered, like, you know, again, this kind of, like, incredibly wise.
Yeah, literally just a god of wisdom. Yeah. I think I like this track. So, and yeah, and, like, they might have... I think even then, the kind of immortality that they have is not necessarily... Like, are we imagining... I mean, we kind of have to address this era Avum by Avum, because I was going to be like, oh, do they exist all the way through all the Avums if they're immortal? And it's like, well, no, they can still be killed, first of all. So probably their death is almost like a guarantee at some point. But also, maybe they're... I'm not against the idea of sort of like a special, you know, VIP lounge for them in the Ethereum. But I also kind of think, like... I can imagine the gods granting them sort of a special position, like almost like, you know, for instance, like Charon, somebody who's, you know, oaring the boat that carries people over. Obviously, our mythos of how people die is a little bit more complex than that. But but like that kind of like unique role where it's like, you know, the one who tends the gardens of the Ethereum or something.
Absolutely. I think that it's one of those things where, you know, my idea of they get a special VIP lounge is more like, you know, they get special treatment rather than, like, literally. They get this one place where they all are at and they, like, hang out and have fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think I'm down with that. That sounds good. And then... Oh, no, that's a whole other thing. I can't open that can of worms yet. Like, okay, yeah. Because, I mean, well, and also part of it is like, do you think all demigods... Sorry, you go ahead.
I think our, like, our Achilles analog, whoever that may be... whoever that may be, they might be the herald of Atar.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, they're just with Atar. Whenever Atar comes into a room, quote unquote, you know, however that works, they, like, announce them. And they want to do that. It's something that they consider, like, a point of pride because they are the greatest of all, you know, warriors.
Yeah. I was actually going to say, so, because I think that there's, I was wondering, like, how flashy we want to make them. And I don't think that it's necessarily needs to be universal, but like, for instance, the, you know, is the great teacher/orator, are they maybe their voice can sort of almost boom, or like that they can talk at a normal volume but can be heard for like acres and acres and acres. Or maybe there's like, you know, is the knowledge god or the great researcher scientist type dummy god or whatever, are they like floating books to themselves? Or is it just, no, they actually go over and pick up a book or something. You know, they have control over knowledge, but it doesn't look like that. But maybe there's some other way where they're just astounding people with their brilliance.
I think that they have godlike power. It's not god. It's not, you know, at the level of a god, but they have incredible power. They're demigods.
Maybe I'd put it this way. Maybe they can pass for mortals, but they have to try at it. They have to actively be working to not. So like a god who sort of, maybe there's like a great reveler or something, you know, who's you know, really good at partying and like gets into bar fights and stuff. If they, you know, they might put their hand on like on a, you know, on a bar and like a drink just starts sliding towards them. And they have to actively control that to not do that if they're trying to remain incognito. That kind of thing.
Yeah. And
it's like, I think they have control over that power. And it's not everything's levitating. I have bad examples, yeah. But like, you know, maybe it's more just like they have to, you know, they're just not getting drunk or something, or they're getting drunk, but it doesn't like negatively impact them or something like that.
Yeah. And I also think that I like the idea that they have godlike power and their like bodies are extra like robust. It's just that they're just like harder to kill. But otherwise their power is pretty limited in scope, but is still like incredible. So like, again, very narrow, but not limited by, you know, but it's limited not by power, but by scope. So like the god of understanding has like really incredible understanding, but can't, you know, can't fucking, what would be something interesting? Can't like win at a sword fight necessarily. Like they might be stronger than someone their normal size, but if someone's incredibly,
they can
skilled
still be
bested sword,
though. If somebody's really good with a sword and they're not,
absolutely.
I mean, they'd still do well in a sword fight in the same way that you give any elf worth their salt a sword, even if they've never worked with it before, and they're agile enough and graceful enough, and there's sort of a body knowledge that they have where they will be able to hold their own pretty decently, but like a master swordsman still going to be able to best a Tolkien elf. If, you know, if the elf doesn't have any experience and the swordsman has been doing it their entire life.
Yeah,
probably. I don't know. You could lore check me on that one.
Yes, I think so. I think that's true. And there was a time in Tolkien's lore that men were stronger than elves.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, I think that this paints a pretty interesting picture of demigods. They're kind of all over the place. I was going to ask, so we have this kind of different divine nature where something about them is sort of being altered. Do demigods all start in the Materium, then ascend to the Aetherium? Are some called to partake in roles that are specifically within the Aetherium? Like you might have somebody who's literally like being recognized. Is it through merit, or is it they see the heart? I don't know. Like, how are gods picking out their candidates? If it is them picking it out versus like either the animus granting it to them, or maybe there's even a third way that's like completely unrelated to those two.
Yeah, I think there is a third way. I just don't know yet. And it's like on the mortal side more so than the divine side. Like they take it.
Well, because the thing is let's talk about that, because we've sort of introduced this as something where the gods are replacing an existing system or process of ascension with this sort of checks and balances of demigodhood. I think, I mean, we've never really been that clear about what makes, you know, one of the things we do know that we have been conclusive about is that it's not just about faith. Right. Like you can have a bunch of people believe in you and that's still not enough for you to necessarily become a god. I think even in Avum Tertius.
Yeah.
I think that there's something like a ritual or a rule. And I don't think it's just sponsorship, but there's some sort of interacting with the ethereal medium in a deep and intense way that allows them that sort of access. And maybe it's that the gods afterwards control that, or they stem that flow, or something to reduce like a person's ability to have access to it. I think they like kind of, yeah, I mean, they really, I think they gatekeep it, right? They literally, yeah. They gate it off and only allow it like, you know, like locks and dams or something.
And the first measure is definitely like going to these people that are either ascending or have had their first ascension where they haven't done another. And they're like, look, we will grant you demigodhood. You get to keep whatever you have now. You get demigodhood as well, but you don't get any farther. And we won't try to stop you. You know, we're not going to kill you. We're not going to do anything like this. You get a free pass for what you've done because, you know, you didn't know it was illegal. It's illegal now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, but, you know, one of the things is
decriminalized godhood.
Yeah, you don't keep trying to ascend. Otherwise, we have a problem. And you swear on this, you know, you swear an oath to the gods to never.
Maybe to the concert
to
or
the
something.
Exactly. To never reveal how you ascended or how you plan to ascend so that, you know, we don't have to deal with this shit anymore. And we will give out demigodhood so, like, it's not like people will never be able to do what they want to do.
Yeah. So this okay. Big okay. I like made. This. Yeah. So afterwards, it definitely has to be like, yeah, you got to get your god card signed by at least a couple of references, you know, maybe one very high elevated god. Like, nobody's going to question a regent who decides to grant demigodhood. Like, that's almost its own separate thing. Like, that's almost godhood as far as, like, mortality can achieve, you know, on its own.
Yeah, if you are the demigod of Atar, like, you are probably as powerful as a great deal of gods.
Yes, I agree with that. I was thinking that. I mean, again, especially because we've talked, you know, you've kind of mentioned, like, the god of a small brook or something in a hidden forest, right? That does exist. I don't know if I'd necessarily call that a...
It's,
I mean, maybe it's a god, but like some sort of spirit. Or... some land spirit, yeah. I mean, I think that there is some divine power in that. It might not be a very dormant and alive power. I think that, you know, sort of like many things associated with Gaia and the other Shorn, they're sort of a weaker, you know, slumbering aspect to them. But anyways, just saying, like, yes, I mean, a demigod of Otar, it just is going to have more power. I think otherwise there's almost sort of this, maybe it's an unspoken caste system. Like, every god can kind of sort of like the Aes Sedai feel the power of the others around them. And so it's not something that is really talked about in mixed company, but like there's an understanding that maybe not in every pantheon, but in many pantheons, a common default is to assume that the gods were more powerful, might makes right, and you kind of just need to go with their flow, or at least not upset them too much, because then they'll, you know, push against you.
Yeah. And there's politicking in these kind of pantheons. There's like, you know, you can get a lot of people to sign on to your god card that are weaker gods, but they can still, if you get enough of them, you'll get a stamp.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe it was actually the Wild West before. Like, maybe during the early, early years of Avum Tertius, like 300 to 500 years in, maybe 700 years in. I think by then they've long sort of set the limits on things and started to heavily monitor these gods, which, by the way, those oaths, I'll bet you one of the things that that like making that kind of oath does is draws into far greater clarity this specific individual to the entire concert. Oh, like, yeah. They can kind of be like this ever watchful eye over everything they do.
And I mean, having just like, yes, having this
in a way that like most mortals don't, like we were talking in the
end, and especially like sponsorship, where it's like, you are my demigod, which means, yeah, like I can see you
anywhere, I can like feel anytime, what you do clearly. I can like feel what you feel, I can see what you can see, I can like hear what you think, you know. Yeah.
Because I think it's like
in a lot of ways, it's like the equivalent. Yeah, it's like you are my eyes and ears in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's like a sharing of divine essence in this interesting way, which is why I don't think the regents give out demigodhoods very often.
Maybe that's what it is, though. Divine essence. Maybe there is something about the... Oh, dude, what if it's sort of like a... It has an unpleasant association with sharding.
Interesting.
In the same way that, like, vampirism is about tearing a chunk of a soul, maybe the gods are way better at it, and there's something different about the way that they can handle it. There's sort of a bequeathing, but it still may carry some of the strangeness of the side effects. Even if it's done in a more holistic way, it's still fundamentally changing the nature of the soul. And so you can do a fantastic job with it, right? Like, you know, these days we can do open heart surgery and get heart transplants. That doesn't mean it's going to be with no complications, right? It's still significantly better than what you could ever do before, but it's still like, you know, you have to be careful with that shit. And it's a fundamental change that will, like, that person will be different forever as a result. And so maybe that's what it is it's literally like some gods that, oh, dude, I can imagine them literally just assigning a demigodhood just as a sign of peace between gods who were, like, in conflict, of almost like having a child to keep the marriage going, of being like, yeah, the three of us are really just not having a good time here. We are not, like, we are almost ready to, like, tear each other apart. So we are literally going to bring a person into this world, or we are going to grant this sign of peace to each other as, like, we're all going to share. And so, like, literally this person just, like, in the middle of the night, you know, maybe they're a decent enough person. I don't know. They're the nicest person in town. They're always trying to help other people or whatever. And they basically get preyed upon by these gods who are in conflict with each other and are like, hey, we would like to offer, you know, like, we've seen the way you live. You are truly, like, a, you know, paragon of your kin or something. And they're like, blessed with this divine power. And it's like a very small mote of their divine spirit. It's just enough for them to, like, feel the world differently and very slightly alter the world. And, like, you know, maybe they never even find out that all of this was just so that the gods could keep peace with each other, so they could sit at the same fucking table and not throw shoes. Unwanted children.
There you go.
Oh, it's so good. Okay, so yeah, because I think that ultimately, and we are getting a little bit on in time here, ultimately, I think it was a Wild West thing, and they maybe just straight up closed off an avenue. Like, there was a way that people could ascend and is maybe, like, forgotten, and maybe what it was is the gods, like, sort of destroyed that knowledge.
Yep.
And they thought they destroyed it completely, and occasionally people slip through because maybe they can't actually destroy the avenue, but they can destroy people's knowledge of it or something. And then to fully sort of remove it, they do what Spotify does. Instead of outlawing, you know, or instead of trying to crack down on the illegal thing, they just make it easier to do the thing with spending a small amount of, you know, your own resources. Yeah. Well, we'll offer you demigodhood, you know, and then they advertise that and bring that to everyone's attention. And so, like, people just are like, well, I could try this thing and invoke the ire of the literal divine beings. Or I could do this officially sanctioned way and, like, maybe achieve demigodhood. I like that. And then, of course, the gods, like, you know, if an animus grants somebody with demigodhood, like, you know, they're just like, well, we can't do anything about that.
I'm just imagining,
you know,
like,
we don't know what to...
Otar is just like, he's just gotten up, he's got his newspaper, he's got his cup of coffee, and then, like, an angel brings him a plate of, like, flapjacks, and they're like, so the animus granted another, then we got her to get an
Otar. It's the equivalent of the obituaries. It's like reverse obituaries.
And Otar's like, oh, you know, who'd the animus granted to this time? And then angel's like, well, not the best
You've
guy.
You've gotta be fucking kidding me. He's literally known as the Butcher. He's murdered over six. What are they doing? Oh, all right, whatever. I guess, you know. Yeah. But yeah, I will say, so as far as the cutting off knowledge and stuff, I think they just get really, really good at it. You know, you give them 1,000 years or something, they really iron out all the details, and they have entire houses that basically work like assassins. They're not necessarily even killing
people.
They're
like,
you know,
the Inquisition.
It might be... Yeah. Yeah, they're like the Inquisition. They might show up in Men in Black style, just, like, extract knowledge from people's heads and then just disappear from the town.
By the way.
And it happens in the middle of night and none the wiser.
That's why they banned books. So they're like, we need to stop this. People are reading and they're reading about God and we don't know where the books are. We ban all books.
It starts with, oh shit, that's so good, because it's they come to learn, like, first of all, what books are, right? Because again, in Aven Prima, everybody has perfect knowledge. They're like, everybody's some wealthy people are, like, carrying around these thick, I don't know, it's called a book, but it's a pile of papers with ink in it, and people are literally standing in front of others and, like, speaking eloquently. Is this some sort of, like, mental augmenter? What is this thing? How are and they just repeated the thing that that person said, or at least the gist of it. How did they, what are these things? And then like they find out more and they're like, and then they start hearing like people preaching about godhood and shit. And they're like, oh God, these things are horrible. We need to destroy all of them. Yeah. So, okay. Well, it's kind of time. I have a couple of, I've got some lore bits. I got some really good lore bits.
I will give you my lore bit. You can have it. Give me the truth of the lore.
All right. Well, the first thing that I was really curious about was all this time we haven't really talked much about a rune.
Yes.
And there are other realms as well, like whole other continents we've never touched because, I mean, when we come up with something cool or interesting to do with it, we'll do it. But at least for a rune, I wonder what the, if they have something equivalent. You know, how they handle sort of ascension and stuff with the wild gods, you know, especially because they literally worship the wild gods. And are there sort of these natural champions in the same way, or they may be different? I don't know. So that was one thing I was thinking could be really interesting, especially because everybody sort of has their spark or whatever we call it, you know, like, or maybe not, I don't think that everybody has it, but
I think there's some blanks.
Many people do.
Yeah, some squibs.
Some squibs, yeah. But it's uncommon. It's like, you know, maybe one third or less of people are quote unquote squibs.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was that I just wonder how this all feeds into ascension in general, because it's still possible. Is there something about demigodhood that says once you do it, you can never become an actual god? Is that maybe the trap or sort of the trap is maybe a little bit cruel, but like kind of, you know, what the gods are hoping for. Maybe there's not really a way to attain true godhood if you, you know, sort of go through these avenues.
So I think it's like a two-part process where like when you become a demigod and you are embodied, your like power is... A part of the deal is your power is tied to your embodiedness. And then when you become merely a spirit after you've died, then you get like raised up and like some juice. But it's like different.
I mean, yeah. Well, and I mean, I think part of it is also because once you are not necessarily, maybe it's almost like selling your soul. Like there is a part of you, maybe through these oaths or things that these gods are making with the mortals, there's, it's like the blood thumbprint in John Wick. Like you're leaving a mark of yourself with them. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You're leaving a part of yourself with them through the oath, and they're leaving a part of themselves with you. Maybe that's actually how all oaths work. And this is a special kind of oath or something that's like a giving of power, right? Cause like they offer their clerics and their champions of paladinness or whatever, the same kinds of things, but not on this, you know, nearly the scale.
Yeah.
And there's something fundamentally different about granting the access to the power versus changing their nature. You know, the origin of the power is now different. Like they share some of this origin, but I think whatever is happening there makes it maybe not impossible for godhood for a demigod, but nigh impossible because they cease to be the entity that they were.
Yes.
And I think there's something about that that means they might just not be able to have access. And so it's almost like this divine stillbirth that the gods are doing.
I've got something interesting for you. It's a chemistry now. You ready?
Okay, yeah,
there's like
sure.
Three types of chemical bonds, from what I understand in chemistry. One of them is super weak. It's hydrogen bonding. And it's just like atoms or like molecules that have like different polarity just like stick together like water. But sure. They can be very easily separated. And I feel like this might be the kinds of relationships like paladins have and... clerics have with their gods, right? It's this like sticking together, but it can be broken fairly easily by the gods or by the clerics with, you know, forswearing.
Or at least comparatively easy when seen in the light of other things. It's like, yes, I mean, you're making a like sort of a lifelong oath if you're a paladin, but I mean, you're not a demigod. Like you can still be an oath breaker. You can turn it around.
Yeah. And then there's
probably different from,
And there's ionic bonding, which is a lot stronger, but with the correct solvent can be destroyed. So this is like what salts are. Like, so, you know.
Okay.
Sodium chloride.
You can dissolve salt in water, but it's just going to sit there as salt otherwise.
Yeah, and it's pretty, like, you can't break it apart physically, like, unlike hydrogen bonds. And so that, I think, might be, it gets to get a little disanalogous here, because I think that might be godhood, where it's like, because the ionic bonding is, I give you an electron.
Mm-hmm. Faith and enshrinement, right? Like, it's like, if you don't have those things, then you lose, like, the sort of the binding.
Yeah. And then the last thing is covalent bonding, which is the sharing of electron. And I think that might be what the seven are doing, or the nine, where it's like the souls are sharing one body in this like weird overlapping way, and that cannot be easily separated. Covalent bonds are
it's really like
hard.
The two become two.
Yeah.
But half of one becomes half of the other.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you have the solar sort of overlapping the mortal, and the and vice versa, the mortal is almost sharing like the presence of the solar. Okay. I like that. I like that's a really good description. I think so. Yeah, I don't know, because the thing is the main thing I was trying to get at is I still like the idea of mortals ascending. It just happens way, way less after Avum Tertius, which by which I mean like it's happening once every, you know.
That's like turning lead to gold.
Yeah, it can happen, at least as far as, you know, things are related in Halume. It's just, you know, more like happening
you can
once Frank, once to 10 times a millennia. Frank, you can, not like,
you can turn lead
you know,
to gold
once a century.
In oh, this well, world.
Right.
It's really fucking right. hard, and of course, nuclear physics. You gotta shoot a bunch of like protons at lead or whatever it is, but you can do it.
Yeah, I mean, you literally just are changing the atomic structure, yeah. But you can do it. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so I think it happens and probably not more than a couple times a millennia. There, I mean, I think there's sort of a divine event that happens like that maybe once every, I'd say 600 to 1200 years, and there's no guarantee that sticks around.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times,
because there's other gods that are rising up all the time too.
A lot of times it's not mortals. It's like a mortal becomes something else, and then that something else becomes a god. Like, rarely is it like you're mortal and you become a god. Like, there's a lot of steps in between, because it's like, you know, a mortal wants to like grab more power, and then, you know, over 100 years they finally like do it and they become this other thing, like a lich or something like this. And then that lich has more time to grab more power, and then they become something else, and so on and so forth.
Right. And well, like we've talked about, for instance, like recollections, right? Recollections are oftentimes a byproduct of, you know, elevation of a mortal to a divine status, where you end up with sort of these shades. I mean, these recollections, these, I think that this person is this thing. And so it almost sort of filters and categorizes. And so you have almost these like cousin entities that are akin to the original, but are not quite the same. And it's just as likely that one of them could ascend as anybody else. And if anything, it's maybe more likely that they'll ascend than the actual mortal, because the mortal is a lot more complex. They're a lot more nuanced than what a whole pile of believers might believe about them and have this dogma about and fixate on, right? Like, for instance, Jesus, you know, the historical Jesus could have been, I don't know, we don't know what his carpentry techniques were. Right. And so if there was the equivalent of this happening with a recollection of Jesus versus the actual mortal figure, it's a lot more likely that the one that is being preached about every Sunday is going to ascend and be true godhood versus like the guy who actually like put tables together. So
probably shit at it, too.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he wouldn't stop being a carpenter. But
no. Did you come up with that?
Yeah, I just came up with that right now.
You think he's like, you know, in Joseph's workshop, and he's like, oh man, I don't know, this thing is working out. And you know, like Joseph's like, yeah, I try, you know, Jesus, I'm really trying here. You can do better. You know, if you spent more time just focusing on this and less time in prayer, and Jesus is just like, yeah, God, I've been thinking about becoming a preacher.
I think I'm gonna pivot.
I don't know if this is really for me. I feel called by God, you know?
Exactly.
Anyways, I'm going to hell for that. No, I'm going to hell for probably a, I don't think there's a hell. I don't know. Whatever.
It's for the cats.
Okay. We should really finish this though. I'm just trying to think, because there was one last thing that I was thinking about. The first ascension, second ascension, maybe not all demigodhood actually comes out of.
I feel like at this point we're talking about like Super Saiyan states. Just like this is what's become like Super Saiyan, know, right? Super Saiyan Full Power, Super Saiyan 2, right. Super Saiyan 3, Super Saiyan 4, Super Instinct, Super Saiyan Blue.
Are these all real? Yeah. Jesus.
Super Saiyan God.
I don't know if this makes me want to get into Dragon Ball Z more or less.
It's good.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think maybe there's a kind of, I wonder if it ever happens in reverse. Like there's an entity that has a kind of godhoodness, but is sort of spiritually malnourished, if you will, and won't ever sort of foment into a true proper god. And so they seek out a mortal to make a connection with and sort of imbue themselves in and do this thing that you're talking about with the 9 and 7, where it's like, we will sort of share a nature and become more than what either of us could be.
Could be like the sage.
I will remain and become permanent. Yeah. From
Assassin's Creed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that. That's pretty cool. All right. Well, we should really call it. Yeah. I think that's the end.
Thanks for listening. If you were pleased by what you heard, don't hesitate to share this with others. Feel free to rate or review us on the podcasting platform of your choice. And never forget to ding that bell.
For references to previous episodes and other fun links, refer to the podcast description. You can find our Twitter and email there, perfect for asking questions on things you'd like us to cover in a future episode.
Thanks as always to Josh the Soapman Soaker for the Land of Heroes theme, and thank you to Sam Wade for the album art. You can find Sam at By Sam Wade on Twitter and Instagram.
Just as a quick reminder, if you were wondering about that ever present, headbutting of whether the gods can read or not, make sure to stay after for the amble, because we kind of explore that. But as consistently this season, we are capping off each episode with a reading from the Book of Truth. So, Master of Feats. I don't know. What are some of the names of Heracles?
I don't know his titles.
What was it called? Like the 9-7 feats that he did or whatever?
The 12 labors.
Yeah. Yeah. Dodeca laborer. Carter, what do you have for us this week?
All right. This is a good one. You'll like this one. If your heart bursts with pride, take care, for the gods grow jealous. But if you are humble in spirit, their grace shall descend upon you.
That's pretty good.
And until next time, that's pretty solid. Don't forget, there are always more Heras to please.
More demi-divine entities to stillbirth because you're insecure about them overtaking your current pantheon. Bye, everyone. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing okay. It's weird to record in the evening. I feel like we haven't done this in like a year at least. I can't remember the last time we recorded this late.
Yeah, it's been a while. I do think it's good that we're recording because I can't do next Sunday because I'll be in Orlando.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to see Paul McCartney.
What's in Orlando? Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah.
He's like 102...
Wait, is he really?
No, he's like 80 or something.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was like, I didn't think he was 40 years old when the rest of the Beatles were all in their 20s.
Let's see, how old? He's 79.
79. Not 80, or not 102, not quite.
He's not 102. But he's not the Queen.
I think that would have meant he was like, gosh, when did the Beatles take off? The 50s, the late 50s, early 60s, like 58, 59? He was born in 42. Did they take off in what, 62, 63 then? Because I think he was probably in his early 60s, 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that should be cool. He's going to play the hits. He's going to play any of his new stuff.
He's going to play some Wings stuff. But
I was going to say, does he have any new stuff?
I don't think that new, no.
I mean, if I was part of the Beatles, I also would just be playing that stuff for the next 60 years.
Yeah.
Just but really God, that good. Sounds I mean, kind so, of I like devastatingly.
Wings the wings, is, wings are good. Band on the Run.
Oh, true. True.
Good stuff.
Oh, what was I listening to earlier? Oh, yeah. Give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I want to get down. Okay. No, I know it's not, but I was just like, I've been going through 73, I think. Same year Stevie Wonder released Superstition.
Is it Drift Away? Is that?
Yeah, Drift Away.
Is and Drift Away.
I don't think so.
No.
But yeah, no, there's some good, there's some definitely some good hits in the early 70s, man.
Yeah. Is Motown on the scene yet?
Motown's come and gone by that point.
Okay, that's the late 60s or early 60s?
Yeah. Yeah, mid to late 60s. Five. You get like, yeah, I mean, well, Temptations, you get, who the does Ronettes. Up on the roof? Yeah, the Ronettes, Don't Worry, Love, bum, 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 bum. You know, like, I mean, disco is basically built off of the back of that. You know, Motown sort of set the stage for being, I mean, one of many distinctly black sounds, but like, disco built itself off of the bones of a lot of what, like, soul and funk were doing and Motown were doing. Good stuff, though. Who is this? This is... Yeah, it's Dobie Gray.
Okay, Dobie Gray.
Yeah. Pink Floyd released Dark Side of the Moon that year.
Is that,
the Temptations
is that
did
money?
Papa Was a Rolling Stone.
Hmm?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the one I added.
Such a good one.
Marvin Gaye did Let's Get It On.
Ooh, Marvin Gaye.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Got some Paul Simon as well. Smoke on the Water?
Oh,
I mean,
Deep
classic,
Purple.
You know, the only guitar chord that anybody learns, you know? Yep. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was a more of the song to that than that. And then I listened to the song and I was like, this is unlistenable. I mean, there's not much more to the song. They pretty much just keep that chord going through the entire song.
Smoking water.
Yeah.
A fire.
Yeah, you listen to a lot of oldies.
Yeah.
It's weird to think that that's from 50 years ago. 73, 50 years ago. I was watching For All Mankind recently. Do you know that show?
No.
It's an alt history if the Russians had landed on the moon first, and then just like the path of history sort of parallels ours, but there's some pretty significant divergences. So there's some like some they play the hits of like big events that happened, but they also
Beatles
like focus
Russian?
It.
The Beatles are Russian.
I mean, shit like that. I think John Lennon survives. Like he gets but the Pope dies. The assassination of the Pope actually succeeds. So, you know, you trade one for the other. And it's like, well, you know, 50-50.
I mean,
but yeah, no, it's pretty good. It's got a real hard-on for Reagan, though. Like, it just can't help but give Reagan a blowjob in every episode during the second season.
Like
which
that.
Is just like, I mean, in good company with Nancy, I guess. You know that? Did you hear that?
No.
A couple of months ago, it came out that Nancy Reagan was like known in Hollywood as being just like a blowjob machine.
Wow.
Yeah, like she was like, I don't remember who said it first, but then a bunch of other people in Hollywood, like she literally had like a nickname that was like a reference to going down on somebody or something, which is just like, I mean, I'm not really one for slut shaming. I actively discourage it, but I'll make an exception for Nancy Reagan. Madam, don't say, just say no.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, no, I mean, I understand why the show is like that, because if you're going to make a show that is very rah-rah, you know, space, NASA, all that stuff, so much of that money and support would come from the military because it's so strongly associated with all of that, but still, it's just a bunch of bullshit. I don't know. Anyways, the show's good though, for the most part, as long as it can keep its politics in its pants. But yeah, it's a good show. You know the guy who is in Altered Carbon season 1?
No, so I'm seeing it.
Okay, it's a pretty good show. don't know. It's okay. I've been watching Arcane too. Arcane, I've been enjoying. Yeah. So yeah. I figured you'd like that. I just got to episode 4, which I'm assuming, I don't think there was a title card for it or whatever, but there's a time jump. I have to assume because Jace definitely looks older, which, by the way, they just straight up ripped that from Magic, right? Like, that's literally just like Jace Beleriand. Like, he literally, him and his mom get saved by a mage and then like warp away to some other land. And I'm like, this is just literally what happened to Jace. I mean, not exactly, but basically.
But he's more like Techno. I like him better than fucking Blue Boy.
I actually don't mind Jace Beleriand. It depends on who's writing him, though. I mean, I'll never forget the Ixalan. The Ixalan storyline is just seriously some of the best actual just fantasy writing I've ever read, which is shocking and weird, but it's good. It's a good anthology of short stories that like come out to be a full story. Anyways, should we do an episode? How are you doing?
What are we gonna do?
Okay, well,
haven't done.
I mean, just like
I haven't What's done up? A.
Go ahead.
We I'm haven't listening. Done a.
Godmill. Oh no, dude! Stuff is cooking too much in my brain for a Godmill today.
All right,
I'm not leaning on that one, but only if I can inspire you too. All right, so some of the things that we talked about, our last episode was Crusades, and it just, like, there were a lot of things that came up. So,
which our last episode, which is me complaining about God's reading, right?
That's right. Okay. It's not necessarily, it was so much clearer in my head yesterday, which is why I was so down that, like, your internet was out. My condolences, by the way. So I have two things. One, I think I maybe have a fairly good explanation for this time why the gods can't read. And two, I think I have a solution for our standoff.
Okay.
So first of all, I think that the gods can't read because the gods can't see very well.
They're like sharks.
Okay, so this is kind of what I was... a little bit. This is kind of what I was getting at with the Waylas and why I think that the Waylas maybe are a good way of describing it. So maybe there was a time where the gods could read. And if something was written, the issue isn't that they can't read. It's that they have fuzzy, blurry vision of reality. We talk about the culminant thread, right? Maybe what it was at the original time. It's not a question of knowledge. It's a question of fidelity of vision. So like during Aven Prima, they had no issues being able to see everything because there was a perfect connection between, you know, the Ethereum and the Materium. But after the culminant thread and everything, when they have to focus so much power just to be able to engage with reality at all, maybe it's, and not just reading, but maybe it's just that events themselves also are difficult for them to interpret beyond generalities. And so what I'm imagining is maybe the way that Waylas work is that there's sort of a template that's a loose reference of something, and then there's, and so Waylas kind of have this cousin similarity, and the more precise something looks, the either maybe there's a more defined Wayla for it or something, but it's almost like a family of Waylas represent a tree, right? And then you get evergreen tree, but not this evergreen tree, right? And so maybe the gods can see general things like, which again, this is kind of getting at we've talked about the idea of a divine mind versus a mortal mind and how it's kind of made of different stuff. And so I was kind of thinking maybe it's just that the divine mind engages with Waylas in a way where it's seeing the thing behind the thing. And so it can see the generality of a tree. And if it looks at a book, it can see the generality of a book. And if it focuses really hard and spends energy on it, they might be able to make out the title and a little bit of like the gist of what the content of the book is. But like it requires effort. And so it's not that they can't read. It's maybe just that they have difficulty like seeing or focusing on any individual thing, especially when they're trying to cast their vision and their mentality so wide and try to monitor so much stuff at once. So, and if they chose to just pick one thing, maybe they could like funnel all of their focus and detect, and not just books, but like, you know, like I was saying, like fine art or whatever. Maybe what they're seeing is the passion of the person's heart imbued in the fine art, but not necessarily like what it literally looks like.
So angels can read, I presume.
I think so. Yeah.
When
I think gods can read
embodied.
Too. Yeah.
And like
if,
the gods,
if an angel wrote in ethereal matter, whatever that is, yeah. wrote in sort of a spiritual text, the same language, the god could read it.
Yeah. And the gods, if they are using an avatar, could read, presumably. They can see more easily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I'm happy with that. I'm perfectly happy with that. And another thing that I want to bring up that actually supports your point, because you might think, well, if a wizard can cast scry and see things clearly, well, why couldn't a god? And the limitation for wizards is scrying same plane of existence.
So that's a good point. Like,
a
literally,
god can see clearly if they're on the same plane of existence.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's, yes, so literally like spell casting sort of augmenting your vision or whatever. And also, I think whatever their version of scrying is would literally be different. Maybe their avatar might have actual physical eyes because they're made out of like material stuff. Mm. But, you know, again, gods have sort of a sight beyond sight, I would assume, as most of their senses are, because they're just kind of built of different stuff. And the way they're interfacing with reality is on a more sort of foundational level or
yeah,
something.
And I do think that they have some very like powerful connections to devout followers, stuff like this, but it's not like an avatar. It's not something that they can't see through the eyes of their followers, like nothing like
mm-hmm.
that.
Right. And I think the thing is this is what I think makes it so that the more time that a cleric spends devoted to a god, or the greater their devotion, the easier it is for the god to see them, because they more clearly stand out like a beacon. But like, it's hard for the gods to make out other people as more than sort of just a mass, because they're very general. There's not like a lot of specifics that they can see. And so they might catch unique things. And so this is true for a lot of stuff. Like art is like this, you know, sculptures and other things, but also just really delicate things that are ephemeral. I'm kind of like using a loosely like Teleran Riyadh, like a burning candle. Like they couldn't tell you how far down the burning candle is, because when they look at it, they just see candle.
I quite like this because it gives angels more of a role to go. And
a very important role. Yeah. They're messengers. Their whole job is they then support and facilitate it. They're the body of the god.
And it gives like, you know, making the mutes similar to this, where they can't see everything either. It gives their like demons and devils and their contracts with mortals much more oomph, because it's like, I need to know what's happening, and I need mortals to be my feet on the ground to tell me what's going on.
Oh, I bet they literally use some mortals as their eyes. Like mm-hmm. they literally just are like, I'm going to ride behind your eyes for a little while and just like have you as an appendage that I can manipulate. Yeah. I could see some gods offering that to people, but not necessarily like only there'd be some level of consent, I would assume.
Oh, yeah. There's one role-playing show I quite like where one of the characters lost an eye, but he's a cleric, and his god gave him the Eye of the Storm as a gift, which he can see
Ooh.
The future with, or
oh,
the past.
That's cool.
And
that's
so, yeah,
really
so basically,
tight.
I think 3 times a week or something like this, he can ask the eye a question and he will see a vision. And if the eye cannot
really
answer,
tight.
He doesn't see a vision and it doesn't expend a charge. But, and it can be a question of the future in which he gets a possibility, or it can be a question of the past in which he sees like a vision of what happened.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So anyways, I don't know. I just felt like that was probably a better in lore explanation of like things that were already going on and fits what's, makes and so yeah so anyways yeah I mean Teleran Riyadh I think is a good example of this, right? Like, you know, you go into Teleran Riyadh and you can't tell whether like where light is necessarily coming from, unless it's particularly strong light, or like you can't there's a vagueness about reality. Is a chair over here or is it over there? Like maybe a god looks at, you know, an entire city and maybe they're able to, I don't know. I think that it's weirdly, I think that all scales would have about the same level of vagueness to them. It just depends on what they're focusing on. So if they're looking at a city, it looks kind of like a generic city. But if they're able to look at a specific room, it still has the vagueness of like sort of squinting and blurred vision, where it's like, well, I can tell that there's furniture in here because I see the waylays of furniture, like the echoes of their, you know, this being imprinted in this place, but I can't necessarily tell more than that. There is a fire, but I couldn't necessarily tell you where it is in the room. So I know kind of what's happening here, and I have like a loose vision of it. And I could focus my power. Like, I don't necessarily think that a god has to step down into reality and use their avatar form, if they have one, to engage with reality. It just requires a significant amount of focus that leaves them sort of expended and taxed. And I think most gods don't dare it because they're probably, like, upholding reality in a lot of ways. And if they loosen that, then things can sort of spiral outwards and become chaotic quickly. So.
Yeah, I dig it. All right, so what are we doing the episode on?
Right. Well, the other thing is really quick, but it actually makes me, I'm almost disappointed that you agree that like this is a pretty solid, finally, kind of explanation for what's going on, because I was like, what if it's sort of our first in lore, this is intentionally vague and we won't answer this question, as like, nobody knows, and it's actually kind of up to the listener to decide how, if they were going to run a game or whatever, whether the gods can read. But I think it's could be, and maybe that's just still true, and it's just that it's intentionally left vague, and nobody ever really knows, mortals never really know whether gods can read. But really, it's not just that they can't read, or they can read, but they have trouble seeing. It's much broader than that, and it has to do with, like, and the gods aren't, I think, like, excited about sharing that knowledge with people. They would rather people feel like they are all-knowing, because on some level they kind of are, but they have this limited vision. Yeah, anyways, I don't think gods are exactly like broadcasting their weaknesses to people. So okay, so episodes, so one of them, we could talk about the late whelming, gods anchoring the waylays of reality to prevent a tyranny of magic being more powerful before the templates were locked in. Like these, like almost tribal engagements between different demigods, and like an explosion of like ascensions happening in a very short period of time. And the gods just being like the gods go from being sort of this like distant benevolent echo of a past era to like coming first as like, you know, saviors, and then like rapidly after, you know, everyone else is like ascending and shit, they're like coming down in horrific force, and just like war between the heavens and mortals, almost like these, yeah, like tribes of people. The idea also potentially that demigodhood was something that was bequeathed or developed as a solution, almost like a sort of a compromise between ascending to godhood for mortals and like giving them an award that's like akin to it, but maybe there's some limitations on demigodhood. I know we've talked about it before. The companions, which is just a name I threw in there, but like tailspun gods of Avum Cortis, which sally forth together to make war, hundreds of them, which together are a threat in the Ethereum and Materium. So like kind of the same idea as the companions from like a Wheel of Time, these like mighty people that this idea of like a mass of them, where they are known as the companions in the same way that the group of the concert is known as a concert. And there are stories of good guys, of bad guys, of betrayal, of like, and because everybody has these like vivid, you know, some person might wake up from a dream, a particularly visceral dream, and say, I have seen a vision of one of the companions, they reached out to me or something. And as a result of that faith, like, and they cultivate it with other people, they become, you know, a new companion who exists, and sort of, they just kind of appear, and like, people are like, oh, have you heard the story of this person? And then, you know, like spread the faith as a result. And then like, you have these small pods of like five or six people or a dozen people who are, you know, of this one demigod slash companion slash whatever they are. Non-regent enthroned gods. So the idea of like maybe three or four at most gods who, I think four is probably too many. Maybe even three is too many, but like one or two gods who might be enthroned that are outside of the regents. Yeah, the invention of demigods is a way to offer mortals a different way to enter godhood, which like maybe the demigodhood ends at some point and like they sort of become part of the fabric of Halume in some way. During the whelming and Avum Tertius, many, many people violating the law against worship. It's an even more tenacious balancing act because you can't go too far into drawing the god's eyes. Like, if you're too avid of a worshiper or like of a follower of a god, there might be inquisitorial forces during this time of, like, you know, this royal. But also because people are terrified of the gods because they're clearly powerful. And there's also these mortals who are ascending. So, like, there's gods abound. The fallout of all war on people's faith during Avum Pentis, we kind of talked about this, but like, the, for instance, maybe there's a dissolution or rebranding of the Martial Pantheon. Like, people are so burned out of it that they, like, the Martial Pantheon kind of has to, like, almost hitch their wagons to other parts of other people's pantheons and sort of disband. Almost as like a demigods. Okay. There's also two last ones. Concert Pay Demiurge, which or Pax Demiurge, which is the peace of the Demiurge. Basically kind of the thing we talked about of, like, what if, you know, mortals were actually just, like, came to gods after Avum Quartus and said, we just want you to go away or to only rule from a distance and do not involve yourselves in our lives. Don't even bless us in the way that you used to. And, like, how did they respond to that? And then the last thing being the aspects being governors of Waylas, sort of a brainstem of interconnected Waylas that are like their body parts.
Demigods.
Demigods? All right, we'll do demigods. Sounds good to me.